Hello, pals o' mine. I first wanted to lift a shot glass to Mr. Peter O'Toole, who, as you know, recently passed. One of my favorite movie lines of his was from the movie The Ruling Class. Someone asks his character, "How do you know your God?" And he replies, "When I pray to him, I find I'm talking to myself." R.I.P. Mr. O'Toole, you are class unto yourself. You truly lived a long and wide life. And then not long after that, we heard about Joan Fontaine, sister of Olivia de Havilland. And I can't remember what it was, years ago, I attended a Nostalgia Film Club convention. I don't think the organization exists any longer, but I obtained a few autographs, Ruby Keeler, Corinne Calvert, Margaret O'Brien, and Olivia de Havilland. And she was the epitome of graciousness. She would sign the program, and she made a point when she returned the program with the autograph to you to make eye contact and a smile. That's class. I know it's not Joan Fontaine, but it's her sister. So to the sisters, another shot. God, and then you have, yesterday, Keith Richards turning 70. And in February, Johnny Winter is also turning 70. I mean, these guys have abused drugs and alcohol, and they're still out there rocking. I don't know. I mean, all these people that have their particular beliefs on life and taking care of yourself and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's a crapshoot, obviously. Obviously. So just do what makes you happy, people. So I have a suggestion for people who are looking for books for kids for holiday gifts, especially the young adult teenage that like the vampire books and those type. I don't think this is as risky, as edgy, but it's still in that supernatural genre. It's a series of them called The Stoned Witch, Stoned Witches series. And the first one is called Four Rubbings, and it's by Jennifer L. Hotes, H-O-T-E-S. And, well, this is what the description says. Halloween. The night the barrier between the dead and the living is as thin as muslin. 14-year-old Josie, haunted by the death of her mother, leads her best friends to an ancient cemetery to rub graves. Convinced she will come away with proof of her mother's spirit at last, the evening takes an unexpected turn as the teens gravitate four ways into the haunted grounds. Set against the backdrop of the rainy Pacific Northwest, four graves will be rubbed, touching off a series of events that will rattle their once mundane lives. From the lonely World War II hero to an accused witch, the people buried beneath the stones have stories that need an ending. The journey to unravel the mysteries leaves the friends wondering if the graves would have been better off left alone. So it's called Four Rubbings. And again, the author is Jennifer L. Hotes, H-O-T-E-S. She also illustrates them. So if you heard in the news recently about the couple and the four children, ages 3 to 10, who were found alive and in good condition after gone missing in the seriously cold mountains of northern Nevada, you know, if you're not experienced in the world of backcountry, hiking, camping, etc., you may have wondered how they were able to keep it together, you know, without getting very ill, injured. What happened was, if you'd missed the story, their Jeep had overturned just off a road, and they stayed in the upside-down vehicle for shelter. They burned spare tire to keep warm, and they stayed together, which is extremely important. They also heated up rocks. There was no frostbite. They suffered a little exposure and dehydration, but that was it. The father kept them safe. He knew what to do. Now, as you know, I talk about my hiking exploits periodically on my show, and I know the importance of packing basic survival items, especially enough water. can't believe how many new hikers don't do that. It just doesn't occur to them. I sat down with Rob Ritchie, an event leader and co-organizer of the nonprofit Sierra Mountaineers Club, or SMC, about being prepared for any hike, day or backpacking.
So I'm curious about avalanche training classes. In what context are you learning about that? Personal use, recreational, or occupational related?
More personal and recreational, both. I've always had an interest in learning more about the mountains because I spend so much time in them, but it's also going to benefit the members of our mountaineering organization so that we're all safer and can pass on that training to those with us.
And what's the name of your organization?
Sierra Mountaineering Club.
Oh, okay.
Also known as SMC.
Of course.
Yeah.
And how many members do you have at...
Well, we have a tier membership. Currently, there are free memberships available where people who are interested in the club can join and attend some of the free meetings. But in order to be part of the organization and go on climbs with us, you have to be a paying member. So currently, we have about 750, 755 free members that are part of the meetup organization. I believe we have about 120 paying members currently, but that's been growing recently.
What ages do you have in there right
now? They vary. I would guess that they start at around 18 or 19, and we have quite a few gentlemen who are in their mid to late 60s.
I bet they've got some stories.
They do. Yeah. And most of them are pretty impressive when you get them out in the outdoors.
Oh, I'm sure.
In great shape still. Yeah.
Setting a high bar.
Absolutely, yeah, for those youngsters out there.
So out of curiosity, avalanches, which pop up in the news once in a while, people get buried, just horrible, horrible way to die. I mean, the suffocation I can't even possibly imagine. Is there any way to know if an area is potential avalanche country? Are there areas that are known for avalanches, or are there things to look for if you are in the backcountry?
Yeah, there are actually are a lot of things that can be clues. Number one is obviously looking at the Avalanche Center on the website, and because they will determine for you where the at-risk areas are depending upon their most recent snowfall. So that's your first method of prevention. But you also learn with time that the aspect, which is basically the direction various slopes are facing, the snowpack layers, which you can evaluate when you're on site to determine how stable or unstable they are, how recent the snowfall is, the incline or the angle of the actual mountain you're planning to climb, all those are hints at whether a mountain's going to let loose or not, and what the risk is.
So what's the avalanche website? What
I believe address? It's the Sierra Avalanche Center that we usually use.
Okay.
SierraAvalancheCenter.org, I believe, but you can Google it if you're interested. I'm not sure the actual website.
Now, obviously, I shouldn't say obvious, but I'm assuming that there are times when there's nothing you can do once an avalanche has taken you down at the speed. Sometimes it's just out of your control. But every once in a while, I'll hear about someone. They've got an air pocket or somehow they're managed to. Is there anything someone can do if they have a minute or two?
Once you're already buried? Or you mean just in general? I mean, there is the general knowledge that, number one is prevention, of course, but once you're already caught in one, there are a few devices that can help decrease your chances of being buried or perhaps killed. One is something called an avalung that you actually put into your mouth while you're traveling. Usually skiers will use this, or snowboarders, not usually mountaineers. But if you're going to be skiing a backcountry slope, you put this device into your mouth. And if you're buried, it actually assists in the exchange of oxygen and blows the air out the back of the pack so you don't form an ice mask in front of your face when you become buried. Hmm. So it's supposed to increase your chances of transferring oxygen and being able to breathe longer under a snowpack layer. There's also inflatable backpacks that help keep you afloat on top of the snow layers so that you don't get buried. Once you are buried, typically, you know, there's not a lot you can do because usually your arms and legs are encased in snow. You can't move. But if you can, they usually encourage you to try to keep an arm or leg side close to the surface as possible as you're coming down the mountain, or to clear an airway in front of your face so that you don't form an ice mask that prevents you from being able to breathe longer so that the air can percolate through the snow. Hmm. What happens usually is people will exhale, form a mask of ice in front of their face, and oxygen can't transfer between that mask.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So, and they usually find that most people have passed because of that when they find them buried in the snowpack layers.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Now, in your search and rescue experience, you probably came across situations that could have been prevented, just stupid stupid moves people
Most
made?
Most of them.
Yeah. Any ones that were quite common that you came across over and over again?
You know, the biggest problem was not telling people where you're going before you left.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a given. That's documented well in multiple books and various stories. Beyond that, because of the various types of accidents we saw, you know, they varied so much. I wouldn't say there was a common theme, other than perhaps people not bringing enough food and water, or bringing a map and compass, or knowing how to use them. Once they became lost or disoriented, they couldn't find their way out.
That's me.
Yeah,
I have no sense of direction.
Another common thing was often older people. When I say older, I say people who are not in generally good physical condition, that's a little better terminology, would often get themselves in a little too far, or go, you know, hike down a steep decline that they couldn't quite hike back up. So we'd find a lot of people in areas where they just had too much eagerness to get there, but not enough know-how to get out.
So it's a combination of dehydration and just muscles?
Yeah, and just, you know, even people with heart disease and such, we would find people down, you know, 4,000 feet down ravines that they just had the attitude that they can do it, and then they can't, you know. So it's being a little more realistic and not overly ambitious, perhaps.
So would you say that first aid kits are probably the one thing that's missing out of most people's packs?
People who are inexperienced, yeah. You know, I have to admit, my first aid kit's probably is more minimal than it should be. But in general, there's only a few basic things you really use most of the time out of a first aid kit.
Well, it was funny. I remember walking just around the river. We weren't really in deep canyon country or mountaintops. But I had just, you know, fallen, skinned my knee. It was not a big deal. And this ranger, you know, pulled up alongside of us and asked if we were needed anything. He just basically wanted to know if we had a permit for overnight or if it was day use. And so one of my friends said, you know, hey, have any Band-Aids, you know, or knee's bleeding? And he says, no, because I don't have that in my first aid kit. Yeah. And out of curiosity, I said, well, what is in your first aid kit? And he says, just for broken bones and sprain. But there's no Band-Aids.
Interesting.
You know, there's no, you know, bacterial creams. And I thought, why the hell wouldn't you have something simple like that? That's crazy.
You would think. You know, a lot of the antibacterial creams aren't that effective. Essentially, just irrigating wounds is your best option, and then covering them with some kind of bandage.
Okay.
Antibacterial creams are questionable whether they're really helpful. Yeah. You know, in a chronic open wound or something, perhaps, but an acute injury, just irrigating it is your best option.
Well, that's what I did anyway.
Yeah.
I really didn't care. It was
well,
just
see,
a skin
then you didn't
knee.
Need him.
No, but it was my friend who was concerned. It was just his response that kind of piqued my curiosity. And
I have a great story if you want me to add it here.
Absolutely.
Mentioning that, we were on a road trip through Canyonlands in Utah about 7 or 8 years ago with my best friend, and we came across a gentleman who had went off the road on his motorcycle, fallen asleep while driving a motorcycle.
Oh, God.
Hit a rock, flipped over the handlebars. We found him not long after he wrecked. And we stayed with him for a while and kind of assessed his injuries. And a park ranger showed up about an hour later because we were so far out in the remote areas on the roads. The park ranger showed up, and he had a good first aid kit. He had a, I don't know if you know, sphygmomanometer, but basically he had a stethoscope. He had a blood pressure cuff. He had all these devices, but when he showed up, he didn't know how to use a stethoscope. The blood pressure cuff did not work.
Uh-oh.
And his first aid kit, everything was expired. He was clueless on what to do. And he panicked, you wouldn't believe it. He'd been a ranger there for 15 years. Essentially, he just never came across anything, so his skills were lost, and nobody evaluated the kids.
You know, that's a valid point, is that medications do expire. Even at home, we don't think about it until we grab it. And, you know, I wonder if that's a good idea to maybe put on your calendar for those of us that are regular outdoor enthusiasts. You know, maybe just every summer, every... I don't know how often you'd want to check it, like how...
You know, time passes faster than you realize.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in Mountain Rescue, we had specific dates we would go through our kits, and it was amazing how expired everything already was.
Did you have a regular routine, like twice a year, three times a year?
No, I think we just fit it in when we had rainy weather.
Just when you thought, okay.
Yeah, when we couldn't train outside, we go, hey, we better go through the med packs.
Because I just wonder if some of them have shorter expectancy than others.
Some medications do, absolutely. Most medications are good for a year or two, but not all of them. And typically, even when they expire, they just lose their efficacy. They don't lose the actual pharmacologic effects. So sometimes they'll be 50% as effective as they would have if they were a new medication. So still not, you know, you're not giving somebody something that's going to cause problems because it's expired. So that's a good thing at least.
Now, does your Sierra Mountain Club, do they offer compass classes?
We have free meetings often once a month, sometimes a little less often, sometimes more. But on average, once a month, we'll have free meetings at the local libraries around the Sacramento region. And we will do various trainings. And if it's something that it looks like people need assistance in, then we will do that. So we've done those. We've done some map and compass at the libraries. We also have incorporated that into our recent mountaineering course. So we spend at least 2 or 3 hours or so doing classroom map and compass work, and then spend a couple hours the next day during the climb so that people can understand how to use it in the field. So that's part of our mountaineering classes, right? Yeah.
So what basic items would you recommend to someone just entering the backpacking realm?
Well, have you ever heard of the 10 essentials?
Yes, I have.
Those are well documented. Yeah.
But I'm talking about the newbies that maybe just wouldn't occur to them. They think they're just strolling down to the park, and as you say, all of a sudden the sun is going behind the clouds.
Sure. Well, I would tell them to Google the 10 essentials. That's one thing they should know. But the basics for anyone, and believe it or not, people with a fair amount of experience often forget these. Just, 2.5 months ago, we were doing a big climb in Yosemite, and I had the expectation of being out by 1 or 2 o'clock, and it took us a lot longer than I expected. Mm-hmm. So I was coming off of a third or fourth class mountain in the dark with no headlamp because I forgot my headlamp. So we all do it. So I will start with a headlamp since I'm the one that's made that mistake. But, you know, water and food is obvious needs. Some kind of a basic pain medication, whether it's just ibuprofen or Advil, because sometimes just a really serious tendonitis or sore feet after a 15-hour hike can really get you. So that's
important. I've noticed too that just aspirin helps inflammation sometimes, you know, certain
sure.
muscle or pull something gets that really helps bring it down and to finish the hike out.
Yeah, so anything with just a little bit of a pain reliever will help out to finish the day.
And also if you're like us, you know, we both day hikers and weekend, keep something in each of them because personally anyway I cannot remember to transfer items from one pack to the other, so I have duplicate.
What actually helps is if you know what kind of trips you're interested in, write it out and tape it on the inside of your cabinets in your garage. That's what I do. So if I'm going on
a
climbing trip this weekend, it's going to be a two-day trip, I've got a list of things that I would take almost every climbing trip because invariably there are things you will forget, no question.
Now tell me about your recent Grand Teton expedition.
July of last year, or this past year, I'm sorry. So July of this year, yeah. Okay, I'll try to keep it brief. This was a trip that the group had decided they wanted to do as an expedition. So we do 3 or 4 expeditions every year okay. that are multi-day trips outside of the state usually, not always, but usually. The Grand Teton was something that was always my fascination mm-hmm. because I spent 6 days on the Teton Crest Trail about 7 years ago. And I remember hiking by the Grand Teton and hearing about the people who actually climbed that mountain thinking they were insane. Why would anybody take those kind of chances and climb a mountain like that? After I finished that hike, a couple years later, I got more involved in a little bit of climbing myself. And even though I'm still, in most people's realm, I would be considered still in the beginner phases of rock climbing itself. It's not a real challenging rock climb. It's just a pretty well-respected climb. So when I had the chance to go back and climb that once I became interested, I couldn't turn it down.
And what'd you think of it?
It was great. We had a great time. Ended up being about a 4-day trip because we had some rough weather the first couple days up at the saddle at about 11,000 feet. Mm. Got a little rain, a little sleet, some whiteout conditions. So we had to postpone the summit push. But last day, the weather broke. It was beautiful. I think we hit the summit by noon, and we're back in camp by 5 o'clock. And celebrating. Yeah, so it was fantastic. We had 2 teams go up. There are 2 primary routes that are well respected. One is called the Ohm Spalding route, and the other one's called the Exum Ridge. And we basically divided up into 2 teams, whoever was interested, and we met at the summit. So it turned out really
nice.
Cool. Yeah. It's a pretty small summit, so you can only fit so many people up there. So
going shifts.
Yeah, it was great. We had a really good time.
So what's next on your and within your sights that you haven't
This is a big year for our group, actually.
Yeah.
We've really grown a lot in the last year, and I've become an event organizer myself. So as an event organizer, I have to plan 3 or 4 trips and lead a group of people into these trips. So I want these to be challenging climbs for myself as well. The first one is there's a group of 14 of us going to Ouray, Colorado in February, in about 2 months. Ouray is a really popular summer town up in the San Juan Mountains in southern Colorado. But in the winter, they have basically a drip system that is placed around the canyon walls throughout the city. and it's up around 8,000 or 9,000 feet of elevation or higher, and the entire city is in a canyon. So in the wintertime, they turn on the drip system, and the walls of the entire town become ice climbing mecca.
Oh, wow.
So we're going for 4 days. We're going to ice climb every day while we're there. So we're really excited about that. Yeah, it's going to be
very cool. Now, yeah. When you were a kid, did your family go on trips, camping? And?
No, you know, I don't think I ever slept in a tent till I was probably 22.
Really?
Yeah. I got interested in hiking when I broke my wrist and had to have surgery on that when I was about 22, 23 years old. A little bit older. Actually, a little older, I'm sorry. I was about 28. And while I was recovering from my wrist surgery, I couldn't mountain bike, which was my passion prior to that. So I started hiking. And that's what got me interested more in the hiking and camping. And it just kind of went from there.
So they must be living vicariously through a...
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My dad in the past has never showed any interest in the outdoors. He's always been fascinated by wildlife and scenery, but he's never acted like it's something he wanted to do. And as he follows a lot of my Facebook posts and some of my videos, I can kind of see this gleam in his eye where he's like, boy, I wish I had a chance I could have done that.
Nice.
Yeah, he really seems to enjoy it.
You're setting a very cool precedent for those who follow.
I love to share these things with people who can't do it, you know, because then they get to see these cool areas that so many people can't.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Buku cool, as my ex used to say.
That's great.
So if you'd like to learn more about their organization, it's SierraMountaineeringGroup.org. They've changed their name to Club, but the website still reflects Group. So again, it's SierraMountaineeringGroup.org. Maybe you're looking into skyrunning, you know, ramping up your running, exercising. It's an extreme sport of mountain running, which is above 6,600 feet and where the incline exceeds 30%. So if you love to compete, like ramp it up even higher, the International Sky Running Federation has posted its 2014 schedule at its website, skyrunning.com. Races will take place across 6 nations in 3 continents. If nothing else, you can just say, God, I'm sure glad that's not me. What's on your bucket list? I have met guys that actually want to go back to what they did for when they were kids. That's on their bucket list. You know, they've already have a career that they've been able to accomplish. They've got their family, you know, whatever other goals they wanted to obtain or didn't want to obtain. And they just want to go back to just the simple pleasures. And if couple of them have mentioned to me model airplanes, flying model airplanes. And one of them told me that they discovered in the high-tech sport of model aviation that they belong to the Academy of Model Aeronautics, or they've attended it, I should say, to finally hone their skills and to learn tips. So I wanted to pass it on to you. It's at modelaircraft.org. And you can find a club in your area to learn more about specific aircraft and, again, helpful tips. And, of course, today, discussing the drones, Ontario, California is hosting their 16th annual AMA Expo on January 10th to the 12th. So you can be part of flying the friendly skies, just in a smaller way. Speaking of traveling, if you would like to help 3 young musicians in the UK, they would like to travel the world in 14 days. Because they're musicians, they don't have much of a budget. They're calling it a social experiment, but really, it's a creative way to travel without a budget. So they're looking at the dates, February 10th to 23rd, and they're looking to you, us, to help. They said they will make awesome music on your doorstep. They're asking for help with a place to sleep, a meal, tickets, a lift, coffee, whatever. So far, they've been contacted by folk in Albuquerque, Bangalore, Berlin, California, Deventer, Dublin, Edinburgh, Las Vegas, New York, Newcastle, Rio de Janeiro, and a couple places I can't pronounce. So if you'd like to be part of this, just think of the stories they could share with you. You know, and how it's going so far. It'd be great if I could connect with, talk to them for my podcast. But anyway, again, they're looking at February 10th to the 23rd. So even if you just want to, you know, buy them a piece of pie, you know, and hear some of their music, what the hell, right? So their website is around the world in 14 days, and that's the number 14, aroundtheworldin14days.co.uk. Do something different. Bring your wine in paper bottles at your next holiday party. Paperboy wine bottles are 80% lighter than glass and made with ultra-green packaging. Check them out on Facebook, Paperboy Wines.